want to talk for a little bit, probably maybe even about an hour now, and then we'll be done and there'll be time for questions. So be comfortable, because probably about an hour. Want to just recap where we've been. We're talking about emptiness kind of means illusory or illusion, and there's a lot of depth to that, but we can begin at quite simple, almost obvious levels. And to take this thread of illusory means constructive. The mind is constructing something. It's building. The mind is building something. It's fabricating something. And therefore, it's illusory. And take this principle, this thread, and just start following. We talked about blame as one of the ways that happens and seeds that whole process. Let's start following a little bit further. Still quite simple, actually, but then we're going to end up going quite deep. And let's stay for now with the emptiness of self, this self sense as illusory. But even within that, let's just speak for now about what I would call the personality level of the self. And there's a reason for just dwelling on that. Partly it's meeting so many people and listening to so many people and for myself, knowing or seeing that nowadays, in our modern Western culture and the safety of our current environment, most of the dukkha that arises for us in this culture where we don't have famine and that kind of thing yet, is actually at the personality level. And that's a lot of where people really, really struggle, and there's all kinds of pain and knots and difficulty wrapped up. And I think that's actually different than at the time of the Buddha and the culture of the Buddha. The whole notion of self, the whole sense of self and personality, they just didn't feel themselves or think of themselves in the way that we feel now is very natural to us. The whole sense of an independent self on a journey with my story and the complexity of psychological personality feels very natural to us these days. It wasn't really there. That's a whole other thing, but just at this level of personality, let's dwell on that for a little bit, because again, here what happens is we construct and crystallize self-view at the personality level. So for example, I'm talking about blame, and that blame, just recapping now, that blame very easily about this incident then becomes a more general conclusion about how I am or how that person is, their personality or whatever. So what was relative to one incident becomes more a general conclusion, more pervasive kind of shame sometimes. So what we get is a lot of self-definitions operating within the mind, within the psyche, at the level of the personality. I am an angry person. I am a kind person. I am a loser. I am weak. I am wounded. I am passionate. I am... these are definitions that ways we define ourselves at the level of personality, and we believe them. They're constructs and we believe them, and then we're kind of tying ourselves into something. Now oftentimes actually these constructs are painful in themselves. I am a failure, or I am whatever it is. To think of oneself in a negative way is actually quite painful. But even when they're positive, I am fantastic, I am creative, I am whatever it is. Even as a positive self-definition, it's binding something, it's wrapping something, it becomes a prison, even when it's positive. And we don't always realize that. What is fixed constricts our movement, constricts our freedom of expression, our freedom of seeing, etc. Some of the ways we define ourselves are actually fairly obvious, and some of the ways are actually quite subtle, and we don't even realize that we're defining ourselves in these ways. sometimes we repeat them to ourselves. We actually hear our own mind calling ourselves or the inner critic or something, kind of, you are something, I am something. Sometimes they're non-verbal. That's interesting too. And how am I going to expose and get clear and then get free of a kind of self-definition that's operating below the verbal level? Sometimes it's not so much to myself that I define, but to others. It's in relationship. I tell people, I'm like this, I'm like this, I'm like this. And sometimes it manifests, again, it reveals itself to in my behavior or the roles I habitually end up taking in relationship to others or in little groups or communities. Always end up taking this role. I'm showing a certain character. Hey, I'm the funny joker who's always getting things wrong or whatever. It has a payoff, but it also has a cost. And again, when that kind of thing is operating, when these self-definitions are operating, they will influence perception. They cannot help but influence the way we start seeing ourselves, others, and the world. They're not neutral, harmless factors. They're powerful in the way they shape our whole world. For example, if I have a negative self-definition, I start to focus on what is negative. Just that definition starts to orient the perception towards seeing what is negative in line with that definition. And more than that, it starts to tint my perception. Things get colored more negative because of the negative self-view, self-definition. And so I'm walking around in the world with that, if you like, way of creating perceptions and channeling, looking and thinking and seeing, coloring it. And what happens? I'm culling, in inverted commas, evidence for the very self-definition through it. It just goes, what have we got again? I got a vicious circle. I've got this self-definition. I start seeing in line and coloring perception to fit with that self-definition. It reinforces the self-definition, which makes the perception in that direction stronger, which reinforces the self-definition. Tight, bound tight, is what I meant before. Ways of looking habitually that tighten, exacerbate, or lock into place our dis-ease and the self-sense and the self-views that go with them. Thankfully, we can practice with this and begin shaking it up, opening it up, breaking it up. And actually just simply sustaining a continuity of mindfulness, a continuity of awareness, does wonders here, can do wonders here. Because if I'm able to sustain mindfulness, you know, not exactly every moment, but generally speaking over perhaps a day, like today, or more, or longer if you're on retreat or something, and there's generally quite a lot of mindfulness, it begins to reveal a lot of times where there's the absence of this quality by which I've defined myself. If I say I'm an angry person, I start to see actually there's plenty of times when I'm not angry, plenty of stretches of time when I'm not angry. Plenty, plenty. Or the opposite, I'm a kind person, or whatever it is, I'm passionate, I'm creative, whatever, I'm not creative, I'm a failure. You see, there's times when that's not true. One also sees, times when the opposites are true. There is the presence, not just the absence of that quality, but the presence of its opposite. So if I think I'm kind or whatever, you know, that's how I've defined myself as a rigid view, I start to see moments when actually I'm not so kind, or vice versa, if I define myself as unkind. If the self-definition was really true, it would have to be true all the time. That's what I am. How could it admit of other movements, other ranges? I start to see the gaps in things. One of the benefits of doing it this way is, through mindfulness, is that I'm not just replacing one view, like a negative view, with a positive view, and trying to coax myself into believing that I'm actually this kind of person as opposed to this kind of person. The continuity of mindfulness will start revealing holes in everything. Everything's got gaps in it. I start to see I can't really fix on anything very much. So it's not that a different self-view has then become rigid and then identify with that. So again, practice, practice, practice. And some of these may sound quite familiar, but it's really about practice. That's what will make the difference. That's what will open things up and free them. So that to begin with, just getting familiar with how this works in the mind, in the heart, in the psyche, it's like where there is disease, or when there is disease, when you find yourself in pain in relationship to something, caught, trapped with difficulty, you can actually ask, is there a self-definition wrapped up in this? That's actually a really, really helpful question to ask. Is there a self-definition somehow wrapped up in this? Is it supporting my dis-ease, my dukkha? And what is it? What is the self-definition that's perhaps lurking here? Sometimes it's really obvious, it says, sometimes it's not obvious at all. But it has a really important place in the fabrication, the construction of the dukkha. I'm describing practice now. So this is the second sort of main practice I'm describing. We won't do it, but I'm just throwing it out there for you to play with if you like. I can also do something a little more thorough, which is take my time, over time, maybe a few days even, maybe longer, a few weeks, and just start to begin to notice and then list, actually make a list on a piece of paper or a computer or whatever, of the ways that I notice that I define myself, of the self-definition, actually make a list over time. And then there's the possibility of actually looking at that list, by making it, putting it on a piece of paper in, you know, 1 to 10 or 100 or whatever it is, actually it's externalized. It's out, instead of just being in so close inside that I can't even get perspective on it, it's out there and I can get a sense of space and distance with it. That's priceless, really priceless. So I can look at it with this more of a sense of space and helpful distance. What then if I, as mindfully as I can, slowly, mindfully start reading this list and actually reading the self-definitions, the items. So I'm bringing mindfulness to what usually operates without much mindfulness. It's usually these are programs, these are circuits that go round, round, around, and mindfulness doesn't even get a chance to get in there. Externalizing it, articulating it, making it clear, and then bringing mindfulness to actually looking at this thing slowly starts to inject mindfulness in. Really, really helpful, where there usually isn't mindfulness. And how does it feel as I read this, as I read through these definitions? Do they strike me as true or not true? And then possible, and this is a great thing to do on retreat, if you're ever on retreat, to take this as a theme. Pick one of these definitions and take it as something to really keep your eye on, metaphorically. And try and develop the continuity of mindfulness, which we're doing anyway on retreat, and begin to notice the absences of this, when it's just, this quality is just not there. And the presences of the opposite. So simple. Do you understand? Really simple. If I don't do it, it's just like, yeah, whatever. If I do it, it has a chance to actually work and break something up. So simple, can be very, very powerful at this personality level. Very powerful. Practice, 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 practice. And how does it feel to begin puncturing these self-definitions, puncturing holes in them, gaps in them? See, this thing is not so solid, so pervasive, so dense, so all-encompassing. How does that feel? There's a degree of liberation that comes, of space, of ease, of relief, actually. And it's really, really important to notice that. The noticing and the feeling of that relief is what allows insight to go deeper. So it's not just an intellectual process, but you feel the degree of freedom that's there. It's really, really important. So earlier this morning we said, well, sometimes it's very common to get afraid or for fear to arise when we talk about emptiness and especially the deep end of emptiness and that kind of thing. This is a really good place to start. Because I let go of a self-definition, perhaps that's imprisoning, and I can feel the freedom that comes from that. And that allows me, as I said this morning, just to trust the next step. Because this little step that I just took felt freeing. You understand? Really, really, if there is that, which there is actually for most people in relation to it, it's really helpful to start very easy, and you're just following this thread. So that was the second one, just a brief explanation. Now, some of you know, some of you have experienced times, perhaps in meditation or outside of meditation, where the whole personality just goes quiet to some degree. Maybe there's a complete fading sometimes of the personality level of the self. All that goes quiet. All those propensities and patterns, everything just goes really quiet. It dies away through the power of the meditation or whatever else one's doing. Sometimes people say, there was no self then. There was, you know, the self was gone, or I had an experience of no self. Actually, I would say it's died down to some extent, and there's still a more subtle sense of self. We could call it the sort of the personality of the existential level of the self. That's still there. A sense of just a being here in contact with the world out there. Very simple, but still there. And the Buddha's teaching is like, that's also empty, that's also illusory, that level too. It's also a fabrication of the mind. It doesn't seem like it at the time. How am I going to see that? How am I going to see through that too, even that level? So, there are, actually, and this is summarizing one of these central themes of today, many ways of looking that we can develop that deconstruct the self. They actually take away the habitual ways that we build up the solidity, the separateness, the contraction of the sense of self, and also of the world. So instead of our usual habitual ways of looking, which tend, as I said, to construct, and solidify, these are actual ways we can practice that do the opposite. They deconstruct. They take away the construction. Do you understand that as a principle? Yeah. Actually, mindfulness is one of those ways. I don't tend to think of mindfulness as in this way, but that's actually partly what it's doing. We say, can you be with a thing more directly? Can you be with this sensation or this emotion or this sound or whatever is more directly? And not get so spun off in your interpretations and the views and the colorings and the projections and the stories and the memories and everything that comes to create this vortex. So that with mindfulness we're not building so much. Do you get that? So that's actually, this principle is also operating even in basic mindfulness practice. Thing is, we can just make it much more powerful than that. There's a possibility of going way deeper than that. And I just want to toy with one of these a little bit today. And actually it's the easiest one for most people, but unfortunately it's not, it's also probably the most limited. There are many, many possibilities of ways of looking one can develop in practice that really go, are very powerful in the way they deconstruct the self and the world. And bring that profound sense of liberation and opening. The easiest and perhaps the most limited, though, beyond mindfulness, is impermanence, the contemplation of impermanence. So that's what I want to just pick out a little bit today and develop a little bit. So what do I mean when I say develop a way of looking? Probably everyone in here is aware that things are impermanent, right? It's not a staggering insight, is it? It's not, you know, my niece is like, one of my nieces, the youngest one, six or seven, it's like probably she's at that age where she, yeah, things are impermanent, everything's impermanent. Okay, so it's good to know that and to repeat that awareness, but this is something slightly, just a subtle shift. So it's not so much noticing that things phenomena are impermanent, because that's relatively obvious. But what would happen if we developed a practice where actually you're sustaining a way of looking that's deliberately tuning in to impermanence, That's what it's interested in, more than anything else, more than the texture or the intimacy with the experience or being with it or whatever. Just impermanence, change, 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 flux. That's what we're deliberately sustaining a way of looking at. So we're noticing impermanence, but deliberately remaining focused on that change, on that fluidity. Tuning the attention into it, repeatedly. Staying with just the sense of change, the sense of change, the sense of change, the sense of flow, of movement, of alteration. The perception of what they call anicca in the tradition, which is impermanence, change. Flux, the birth and the death, that's what we're interested in. Everything's being born and then dying, born, birth, death, birth, death. That's what I keep tuning into, that level of my sense of things. The shifting textures, the dynamism of things, the fluidity itself, that's where I tune into and keep trying to come back to. I don't have to force this to see something really fast, if some of you know certain traditions. A lot of emphasis on seeing really, really fast impermanence. Actually, I can just let change reveal itself as fast as it is in the moment and let that take me deeper and deeper. So, check it out. Let me try this. So, if you're really new, you may not even be familiar with the teachings of mindfulness or bare attention. So, we tend to, for instance, when we ring the bell, to really bring the attention to the texture of the sound without ideas about it's a nice bell, it's a not, I wonder if it came from Burma or Hackney or whatever. It's just bringing the attention as much as directly as possible, the actual texture of the experience. So many of you will be familiar with that kind of teaching, right? For some it might be quite new, but do you get the principle? Yeah? So this is taking that just a step further. I'll explain why all this is important in a minute, if you're feeling like seems a bit irrelevant. Taking that a step further, I'm going to ring this with the microphone and see if you can really prioritize, just again and again, tuning in to the shifting of the textures, the pulsating, the waving, the way that the sound actually changes from moment to moment. Pulsating with it? Could you hear that? Yeah? Okay, so that's, I'm just talking about how you would practice this. That's what you would be tuning into, more than anything else, just noticing that change, putting yourself intimate with that sense of something undulating or changing or shifting its textures. So when we can really expand and deepen this practice, and I'll explain why after I just outline it a little bit. If we take a sound like the bell, or a sound of an aeroplane, or something else, there's a way that the mind can focus on that sound. You take one object, and then narrowly focus on the impermanence, on the change in that one object. Okay? And then, of course, just like watching the breath, the mind moves off, it gets distracted, or whatever. No big deal, just not a big deal. Just like with the breath, come back to that sense of change in that object. You can also, when the mind moves and then comes back, it's also impermanence. The mind is changing then. Do you see? So, do you get that? So it's not that you can't go wrong with this practice. Even the mind moving, it's just more impermanence. Everything, whatever happens, you just put it in that channel, impermanence, impermanence. All I want to see, it's like I've got glasses on, all I want to see is impermanence, like Polaroid lenses on. That's all I'm interested in. Whatever happens, mind, body, environment. We can also listen in a much more open way, instead of a narrowly focused way. Like what right now, if you actually just open up the listening, 360 degrees, wide listening, sounds from all directions, the voice, the shifting textures of the voice, sounds from within the room, from out of the room. But it's the impermanence, the shifting, the fluidity, the change, the birth, the death of sounds. That's what I'm tuning into again and again and again. Doesn't matter what sounds they are, nice, ugly, wanted, not wanted, it's all just shifting. Can you get the sense right now? Do you get it? Everything, all this arises, shifts for a while, and then passes away. Born, dies, born, dies. You could do it with the body sensations. So if you take your right thumb, or left thumb, whatever, and there's a place somewhere around where the jaw curves. And if you press, it's actually a little bit intense there. You can find, just jiggle around until you find that. Press it, you know, reasonably hard without doing damage. And then just keep pressing and stay sustained, the attention on the change. See how much fluctuation there is within that sensation. Yeah, it's throbbing, it's changing, it's shifting, it's undulating, ebbing and flowing. So you're really tuning the attention. You're sustaining a way of looking. You could do it with the whole body. The whole body. Just opening up the field of the body and just like we were doing when we're standing, just open to the sensations. Come and go and shift. You could do it with taste at a mealtime. What would that be? I mean, we just had lunch, but well, you put something in the mouth and the subtlety of flavors arising and disappearing, shifting, getting stronger, ebbing away. Change, change, change. Could do it obviously with smell, could do it with sight as well. That's quite interesting. If I do this, you can say, oh, he's waving his hands around for something, but could you see this? Can you see it as just shifting textures in the visual field? Do you understand what I'm getting at? It's a different way of looking. I will explain why this is relevant. But do you understand? We're shifting the way of looking. You're practicing a shift in a way of looking. This is immensely powerful, it turns out to be. And it's by far the most limited of the ones that are possible. But so there's a possibility also of just tuning the pleasantness, unpleasantness of things, and just noticing, like for instance with the food in the mouth at lunch, and just noticing, wow, explosion of pleasant, and then really not, and then something that's not that nice, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Same with the body. All this shifting of textures. Could do it with thoughts, when the mind is a bit more settled. Just like we did with the standing meditation, settle in the body, open to that, then open to sounds. And all of it's just coming and going. And then quite naturally at some point, thoughts will be included. Just the impermanence, the changing, birth and death of thoughts. Just that practice with thoughts makes a huge, if one really develops it, it's hugely powerful. Changes the relationship with thought long term. Instead of just always being entangled because I'm following this, following that, believing this, and we just start to have a whole different relationship with thought through seeing that ephemeral nature. You can also do it with everything at once. So just open the awareness, a kind of global awareness, and just change, 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 flux. Do you get the idea, right? Okay. You don't look very impressed. If we were on a retreat, if this was, let's say, a 3-week, Kate did this. Maybe as well as I just recognize Kate right now. What was it, a month or I can't remember, 3 weeks. And I gave 3 practices. This was one of them. incredibly powerful. Listen to whatever. Incredibly powerful, but practice, 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 practice. That's what will make the difference. You listen to something, it's just words. It's just, yeah, I'm kind of tired, it's 2:40 and whatever. But it really is powerful. Why? Why is it relevant? Why? What's the point? What would be the point of doing this thing? I'm just taking this one thing back permanent. Well, as Kate would probably testify, if you do this and you sustain it for actually just for a few minutes, I would say, for a few minutes, and you really just keep trying to do that, tune into the impermanence, you start noticing something pretty interesting, which is that letting go starts to happen right then, and not in a conceptual, intellectual way. It's not like, oh yes, my goodness, things are impermanence, therefore it would be a really good idea not to cling to them because they're going to change, so I should let go, and that then I will feel better at some point. Somehow, right then, as I'm looking, as I'm tuning into the very impermanence, I'm just sustaining this moment to moment, something happens in the consciousness, and let's go, let's go, let's go right then. And letting go feels freeing. There's release, there's a sense of release, of openness, of lightness, of release, right then in that moment. And that's actually what we're after. That's the point of practice. Release, relief, freedom. And it feels good. It should feel good. It doesn't take that long, but you have to actually do it and develop it. And you start to feel that very powerful. It just gets deeper and deeper and deeper. Quite intense. So it basically brings letting go. We start letting everything come and go automatically, organically. Palpable, strong freedom that comes out. So that's one piece. But second, this self-sense, it feels so fixed and permanent when you feel into the sense of self. And so, well, I know that bits of me change and my body doesn't look the same as when it did, you know, when I was a young boy or whatever. Aspects of personality maybe develop. But still somehow we have this intuitive gut feeling that there is something solid and fixed and somewhat permanent here, somewhere here. That's the sense of self. When you really start developing just this practice of impermanence, this way of looking at impermanence, you start to really see firsthand, I can't find it. I cannot find this sense of self which seems so real, so undeniable, so unquestionable, so palpable, palpably obvious. I cannot find it. It's not there to be seen. I will not find anything that is not impermanent. I cannot find anything fixed, nothing at all, nothing at all. And I see that not in just an intellectual way, I see it firsthand in a way that really makes a deep impression on the consciousness, deeply liberating impression on the consciousness. Where is this self that I so intuitively sense? Where is it? I cannot find it. All I see is change. At this point, let's go off on a little bit of a tangent, but it's an important one. So, some of you will be... You guys okay? Some of you will be familiar with the Buddha's teaching on what's called the aggregates and the khandhas. That there is this body, this materiality of the body. There are feelings, there are perceptions, there are thoughts and intentions, and there is consciousness. Sometimes that teaching is interpreted to say, this is what the self is. You are not a personality, you are not a fixed self, you are a process of these aggregates. You're a process of phenomena like thoughts and feelings and sensations arising and the knowing of that. Phenomena and consciousness. Phenomena, that's what the self is. It's this impersonal process happening in time. Have you heard something like that before? Okay. The Buddha didn't actually say that. It's somehow, I don't know what I'm saying, misunderstood perhaps. To feel oneself, and again, meditatively, some of you in this room may have had that experience at times. Actually, the whole personality dies down, one just feels this sense of a process. Sometimes it can be very beautiful, this sense of just a process unfolding in time. Very simple, kind of miraculous. and very freeing to a certain level. But it's just what I would call a level of deconstruction. It's only a level of deconstruction. It's not yet fully deconstructed. It's not the ultimate truth of the self, that the self is a process in time. It's not. Let's pause for a minute. Right at the beginning of the day, I said I'm going to try and say something for everyone. And so it might be that the blame thing was great, that's it for the day. It might be the self-definition thing, that's it, thank you very much, got something to go away with. It may be this bit now, maybe that this bit now feels like I don't know what you are talking about. That's the difficulty and the challenge of speaking to groups larger than two or three people, really. And this is a large group. So, you know, it's just a few more minutes, so, half an hour or something, 20 minutes or something. But just be aware, you know, there's lots of people in the room, and everyone needs something different. Someone might have just heard something they'd never heard before. I thought that Buddhists were saying it's a process. I thought that's what the self was. Now I've just heard it's not a process, that's not the ultimate truth. What then is the ultimate truth? So even if you're not following this part, or if the part earlier was boring because you knew it already, just hang, you know. That sense of the process, the self as a process, is a level of deconstruction only. It's only a level of deconstruction. To me, it's a kind of reductionist view. I don't know, how do you feel if I say to you, your true nature is just an impersonal process of experiences and consciousness and knowing of experiences and thoughts and happening in time? How do you feel that elements, how does it make you feel?
That it can't be all.
It's what?
That it cannot be all.
Okay,
that
yeah.
It's devaluing something.
Yeah, okay, it's devaluing something. It also seems to me it's a little bit cold and mechanistic. Do you get that sense? It doesn't even... So it's a way of looking. It's a possible meditative experience, very valuable at a certain level. It's a way of looking. It's not the ultimate truth. Reductionism does not reveal ultimate reality. It's a reductionist sense of the self. At a certain level, it's not ultimately, but can be really important. It's a way of looking. So sometimes we're meditating as just the mindfulness and or through this impermanence thing that we were talking about and outlining. And you start to get what starts to come organically in the experience, and some of you will have had this experience, is a different relationship organically with that which we usually identify with. So we feel the body, but it doesn't feel as it usually does to be me or mine, because that's how we usually sense the body. I feel it intuitively as me or mine, or the thoughts, me or mine, or the emotions, or the intentions, or the awareness, me, mine. And something happens through meditation, either through mindfulness or through this impermanence or by itself, that actually there's a disidentification that's happening. And the body sense feels like not me, not mine, but just happening. It's just happening by itself, if you like, or there's a sense of space that's coming there. The thoughts, the moods, the intentions can be a whole wide range or just one particular thing. There's this disidentification that feels very liberating when it happens. It might be scary at first, it might be unusual, unfamiliar, but actually extremely liberating. The tightness of the self-view that identifies all this stuff, these aggregates, as me or mine, is being loosened in that moment. Relief, release, freedom, beauty, openness, lightness, dissolution. Something very lovely and experienced that opens. But I would say, even that is not the end. We can still deconstruct further. And what happens then if we start taking that more deliberately? So I've got a few tastes of this sense of feeling things as not me and not mine. What happens if I just start to encourage that as a way of looking? And I start to deliberately sense the body, the sensations, the thoughts, the consciousness, including awareness, as not me, not mine. And some of you all have heard teachings saying, you're not the body, you're not the thoughts, you're not your personality or emotions, you are awareness, you are consciousness, you are the witness. Have you heard something like that? Again, the Buddha is saying definitely not, you're not even awareness. So that going down to that level where there's a kind of disidentification with all this stuff, but a subtle, either deliberate or implicit identification with awareness, that's a level of deconstruction, a level of freedom, very beautiful, very helpful. And then, when you're ready, a step further. Not even the awareness, even more liberating, even more radical. So what we have here, is to say something I said earlier, is different ways of looking that we can cultivate, opposite to our usual ways of looking, which tend to solidify, fabricate, construct, compound suffering, self, and world. And we have ways of looking that do the opposite, deconstruct, open out, dissolve to different degrees. That last one, this seeing things as not mere mind, is incredibly powerful. A meditator learns how to develop. It's a real skill. It takes time to develop it and develop its range. Extraordinarily powerful in what it can open up. So they differ in their strength. The impermanence one, as I said, is actually quite limited. It tends to reinforce time. And I think the very notion of impermanence involves time. And right at the beginning, if you remember, we said time is actually empty as well. There's no time. Impermanence is not an ultimate truth either. You can go even beyond, deeper than impermanence. That's not to say that things are permanent. Some, going right back to the beginning, some radical mystery is being pointed to here. Yeah? That has the power to open up our sense of existence way beyond what we might imagine is possible. Bring a quite extraordinary degree of freedom into the being. But let's come back to this impermanence, because that's what we're touching on today as a vehicle, the impermanence as a vehicle. Whether it's through mindfulness or whether through contemplating impermanence, we start to see the gaps, the holes in things. So like when we talked about the self-definition, you see this thing that seems so solid, I start to see there's absences in it. You start to see the change. It's not so fixed and solid, this self-definition. But we can also, when you start using this impermanence practice, it also starts to reveal the holes, the gaps in objects as well. So for example, one day I wake up and I feel this heaviness in my chest. I feel down with sadness or depression or whatever it is. And right away, my sense of that sadness or depression is of something solid. And that very solidity makes me, it's too much, I can't go there. It's just, I feel overwhelmed, I feel scared of it. I don't want to go towards it. If I can bring this impermanence practice to bear on the actual, for example, the physical experience of sadness, that heaviness in the chest, or the physical experience of depression, that weight in the chest, that lockedness, and really look at that and see the change. Oh, it's got much more change in it than it seems at first. And really tune into that, changing. What do I see? A moment of sadness, another moment of sadness. The next moment is kind of just peaceful. That's funny, no sadness. Sadness comes back for a moment. The next moment, joy comes. Where did that come from? The next moment, sadness again. The next moment, nothing much. It's got all kinds of holes in it. You're puncturing this solid thing at a much more minute level. You get the picture? And there's a sense of this thing that seems so solid and therefore so heavy to carry, so burdensome, is actually much lighter, much more spacious, really, when I look at it this way. I start to reveal a lightness. It's much more handleable. All with, you know, the English weather, and it's raining and it's windy, and you know, I don't want to go outside. It's terrible weather and it's a solidified thing. But what if one went out and started, same thing, practicing impermanence? What's actually moment to moment the change? And maybe there's some cold wind that brushes the cheek and then feels okay, feel the warmth of the rest of the body, and then a moment where a raindrop falls down the back of your neck and is uncomfortable for a few moments. But even within that raindrop trickling down, there'll be all kinds of change, all kinds of gaps in the unpleasantness of it. Do you get what I'm saying? It starts to dissolve the solidity that we project onto things. But again, I would really say that that's a deconstructed view and a reductionist view. So it's not that the reality is these micro moments either. It's just a helpful way of looking. But important. Because if we tie this in with the theme today, what we want to understand is what is fabricated, what is constructed by the mind, and how is it constructed? And that this impermanence practice is one of the ways that we can begin to do that. When I was a kid, I remember those drawing books. Did you have these? They had numbers on a page and dots, and you would join the dots, go from 1 to 2 to 3. They're called dot-to-dot drawing. Do you remember this? This is what the mind does. It's joining the dots and creating the sense of a whole and then falling for the solidity of a whole, whether it's an emotion, whether it's a self, whether it's a weather, whatever it is. Do you understand? I have to see that. I have to see it firsthand. The mind is joining the dots. The joining is not inherent in the object. Really important to see. I need to practice to see it. We can take this, get that bit, dot to dot, and take it just one level, little bit deeper. This individual dot, let's say this moment of heaviness in the chest, this moment of sadness. Okay, so I see, I'm joining the dots and I create this hole that's just, oh, the heaviness of sadness or depression or whatever it is. I've created this hole. That whole, we're saying, is a fabrication, is an illusion. Okay, so the whole, we say, is empty, illusory. But then, this individual dot that I'm feeling right now, this moment of the weather, or this heaviness in the chest, this sadness, is actually felt and interpreted with all the weight of the sense of being part of the whole. Do you understand? It's got the burden of being, it's not just an isolated moment of something, it's got this sense of it's part of this bigger whole. Am I losing you guys, or are you still here? When I can see, I join the dots, I create a whole, and that whole is a kind of fabrication. So if we say the whole is a bit illusory, yeah? But then this individual dot, I'm not experiencing it independent of this sense of the whole. It's like I bring back that sense of the whole and it's injected in with all the weight of the whole. So it's not just that. So this dot, individual dot, has just got a lot heavier by virtue of the fact that I fabricated the whole. And then guess what? The whole that gets fabricated is heavier still because I've got heavier dots. And then the heavier whole falls back to the heavier dots. Right? It doesn't really happen in time. But there's something is getting built up. We build our experience in ways that we don't really recognize. So again, I can start to see that this is the case, and then start to actually deliberately contemplate this in a way that deconstructs, lightens, dissolves. So, wrapping up now, but I'll say something for the third time at least, which I've said today. Typically, we could say what delusion is, what it does, is we have a habit of ways of looking, meaning ways of relating, conceiving, viewing, perceiving. Self, things, others, environment. We have habitual ways of looking that solidify dis-ease or exacerbate it, solidify selves, build, construct selves and objects. That's the habitual. We don't realize that's the habitual. We walk around. This is what we call existence. This is what we call life. That's what life is. It's construction. We don't think of life that way. It's construction. And what's possible is actually learning powerful ways of looking that start to deconstruct, start to dissolve, start to open their skills, their practices. Easing the dukkha, relieving, opening, dissolving. So, this not me, not mine is one of them. The impermanence is one of them. Mindfulness, we said, is one of them. metta is also one of them, loving kindness. Some of you may know this big awareness practice, sometimes it's called big mind. That's also a way of looking that deconstructs. It's not an ultimate truth. But let's take the metta. How many of you are familiar with the loving kindness practice? Well, quite a lot, great. If you really do it a lot, I don't know whether some of you have noticed this, when it's really going well, you're really in the groove of it and it's kind of humming along, how different the self feels then, how much softer or more open or lighter, how much more beautiful this self and the selves of others, and the world too. Have you noticed this? Different self, different world perceived at that point. Compare that with that other end of the spectrum we talked about earlier this morning, the vortex of papancha, the solidity, the obsession. Very different self, very different world, very different others, right? Perceived. And in the middle is our normal, what we call normal everyday. So you've got metta, normal, papancha, in this spectrum. Each shaping, constructing, revealing a different self and a different world. Which is the real one? Which is the one that reveals the real reality of things and self? I should think. What's the answer? Okay, that's nice. It wasn't quite what I was looking for. Ashok, why are you shaking your head? Why are you shaking your head? Yeah. You what? Yeah, none of them, it just moves. There is no position on that spectrum that reveals an objective reality. Going right back to the general points I was making earlier. But I have to see that. Again, it's not just intellect. I have to see that. Move along that spectrum. That's what a meditator does. He moves along the spectrum. You start to see what I see is colored, is shaped, but is dependent on the way I look. That's the ultimate truth of things. It's not independent. What I see, it's dependent on the way I look. And we can construct and deconstruct and construct differently. And then I see, well, what do I want to construct, given that that's, I've got that spectrum. Where do I want to hang out? What do I want to construct there? But there is no point of reality. Some people say, no, mindfulness will be. Mindfulness reveals reality, but it doesn't. If you do pick up these practices that I'm suggesting, you start to notice at a certain point, or recognize, that actually even what we call mindfulness, basic mindfulness, has subtle grasping involved in it, and subtle identification. There's still a sense of, I am aware, or I am being mindful, or some subtle tussling with experience, and that's all fabricated, that's all fabricated. Mindfulness is not some neutral, objective stance on things, absolutely not, despite all the language that we tend to use as teachers. It's completely not.
We're still cultivating something.
We're still cultivating something, we're still constructing something. Yeah, it's still a construction. It's a very helpful construction, but only to a certain extent. Start to develop these other ways of looking, these more powerful ways of looking, something much more amazing starts to happen. Everything starts dissolving. Self and world start dissolving through the way of looking, fading, opening, disappearing. What on earth is going on? What is going on? And I know that some of you had this experience. What does it mean? It means that my very way of looking constructs the world of self and experience. As the Buddha said, it's all a mirage. It's all a magician's illusion. I have to see that in practice over and over, very deeply. It's utterly revolutionary, topsy-turvy, radical understanding. Nothing is independent of the way of looking, of the mind that looks. But that mind too is also empty. It's constructed in the process, even more magical and radical. The Buddha said, whatever is considered as true by the world with its deities, its meditators and priests, its royalty and common people, is rightly seen as it actually is, with right discernment, by those with some awakening, what he calls the noble ones, by those with some awakening, as false. Whatever, everyone agrees, this is true, it's obvious. With some awakening, that's false. And then he says, whatever is considered as false by the world and its contemplatives and priests, it's royalty and common people, is rightly seen, as it actually is with right discernment by the noble ones, as true. Opposite. Something completely counterintuitive is being communicated through these teachings. Completely surprising, radical, say revolutionary, magical, actually, magical. And that's an interesting choice of word, but actually, in the end, all we can say, not even empty, just magic, magic. There's something in seeing that that frees profoundly. Last point, very, very brief. Emptiness is also empty. There's nowhere to land. There's nowhere to land. All the Buddha cares about is freedom. That's the point of all this. It's not some dogma or some, oh, now I'm attached to emptiness or awareness or whatever it is. It's all empty. Emptiness is also empty. It's only a tool, like we said earlier. You can pick up the views, the ways of looking at emptiness, and then put them down and pick up non-empty views, other views. There's this flexibility, this freedom. Freedom to see differently and to see in ways that free. And that's certainly emptiness is the most powerful, powerfully freeing way of looking. It's only one way of looking. That's it. And that's just freedom. It's just freedom. And that's what the Dharma is all about. That freedom and compassion. Not about dogma or attaching to this or that. So let's take just a few moments of silence.